because the grandmother.
There is a lot to talk about.
Okay, now we're recording.
Dance epidemic tonight.
Also, Gantz Revolution. Recently, I had to review Gantz for Anime News Network on Shelf Life, and I gave it a rental shelf, but you can read my review there, obviously. But I would never have finished watching the show if I didn't have to, if I wasn't getting paid to watch it, because I really dismissed it based on, I also had to review the first volume of the manga for Publishers Weekly, and I don't think they ever used the review that I wrote because it
was negative.
Scathingly negative.
Yeah.
I should bring it up. I probably have it here. But Noah has a lot to say about Gantz, and so we thought we would record a podcast. Actually, I think you specifically said, like, we need to record a Gantz podcast.
Yeah, well, we probably should, because there is a lot to talk about. I hope that it's fresh enough in my mind where I'll be able to discuss it, you know, fluidly.
Well, let me stop. Dance epidemic tonight! Okay, where's my 20 words about Gantz? It's not 20 words. Kay Carano, a despicable high school freshman, with a quote, "I may look stupid, but I know better than everyone else in the world," finds himself helping an old friend, the more likable Kato, save a drunk from an oncoming train in the station. Both boys are killed and transported to a strange locked room where a group of other recently deceased characters try to figure out if they're on a reality TV show or not. A strange black sphere in the center of the room provides weapons and gives orders to kill an alien. Gantz is nothing if not blatant. Kay and Kato's bodies explode into well-rendered guts and severed limbs in the first chapter, establishing the book's standard of gory, well-drawn splash panels. A transporter beam reconstructs each character as an MRI scan would, in horizontal slices every time the characters travel. A supposedly beautiful, naked, suicidal girl is drawn in full frontal glory more times than one might think was possible. No plot questions are answered in a staggeringly brief first volume, and few members of the 8 characters cast are established. The book reads like a grocery list. Okay, give me the good part here. The book reads like a grocery list of things teenage boys might want to see in a comic. Totally nude girls, guns, aliens, high-tech alien guns, guts, severed heads, vomit, and exploding bodies. I can't say I was expecting the near-rape situation and canine cunnilingus. More disturbing than the latter is that more than one character considered molesting the unconscious suicide girl. And I wrote that in, like, July 2008.
Yeah, and that's a pretty accurate review, I think.
Yeah, Volume 1.
Of Volume 1, but having seen the whole series,
right.
That happens.
Right.
That is there.
I missed the point eventually. Like, the Gantz is disturbing on a couple of levels. And we'll
by the way, because Gantz has been out now long enough, the usual spoiler warnings, or I should say, what is it? The spoiler.
The expiration of statute of limitations?
Yeah, the statute of limitations, precisely, for spoilers is off. So we're going to discuss the entirety of the anime, at least.
We're going to spoil the hell out of it.
Yeah. Perhaps the manga is different. I don't know.
I really think
haven't
it's a kind of
the whole thing.
I think it's a kind of series too, where you have already watched it to the end. If you liked it, and if you didn't like it, spoiling it is not going to ruin it for you.
Right.
You can also you could just then go and watch it. Like, it is readily available as the manga and anime. Anyway, so I feel nothing bad about spoiling it.
Yeah.
No regrets.
Pretty much.
Yeah, because I would not have kept reading it after one. But anyway, go ahead.
And it is pretty brutal, as Nathan Explosion might say, because what the first episode sets you up for is exactly what is ultimately delivered. over the course of, it was a 26 episode series, right?
Yeah.
So, more guns and explosions and gore and sex and
violence. It sets you out to, it's also throwing it in your face that you like those things.
Right. Well, this is the point that Dave from Fast Karate made when we, before we'd seen it and we were discussing it with him, he has seen it. And he said that it's actually a very interesting commentary on entertainment because on the one hand, this is what you are supposed to want. This is what the marketplace is providing. And yet you are kind of actively encouraged to dislike it, or you should dislike it.
Right. It's shaming you while you watch it.
Right.
Because in many scenes, like in the opening initial scene where they're saving the two guys, are saving the bum off the train tracks, lots of onlookers are watching this take place and nobody else is helping. And it's one thing to just think like, oh, they're so cold-hearted, but the anime gives us the omniscient third-person perspective, I think the manga does too, where you get to hear the thoughts of those bystanders as they're all like, oh, how horrible, what a waste of human life, I don't want to get involved, and I'm a jerk. Like,
right.
They don't say I'm a jerk, but they're pretty much like, I'm way too selfish to help out.
And so
you have to watch someone.
You hear all of the banal thoughts that these people have, and then after the drunk falls on the tracks, they gather around in a crowd and are
taking cell phone photos.
Nothing. Yeah. They're just watching him.
Maybe I'll get to see a dead body.
He lies there. And you may recall from Blade Runner, right? The test that one of the replicants is put through at the very beginning.
Maybe I don't remember.
Well,
it's been like 20 years.
It's a trivia point. I've now forgotten what the test is called, but it's an empathy test essentially, and
for androids,
right, to determine whether or not he's a replicant.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
So one of the questions that the soon to be deceased examiner asks him is, you know, you're walking in the desert and you see a turtle on its back.
Oh, do you fuck her?
Yeah. And you're just looking at it and you're not doing anything. And then Lenny or whoever the hell that guy is,
I don't know,
says, what do you mean? What do you mean I'm not doing anything? Then the examiner is like, tell me about your mother. He says, my mother? And then he shoots him.
Whoa.
But that's neither here nor there. The point is, this is an empathy test, and the people on the platform are failing it. And it seems initially that this is just sort of the setup for the plot so that these two characters can be killed and the action can can progress, but it's actually not. It's not like it's an unimportant random incident that results in their deaths. There's actually something very key to the way that the entire series will unfold, because there is one empathetic character, Kato, who's standing on the subway platform, and he jumps down to try and get the guy off the tracks, and he notices Kay, his old friend from
elementary school. They don't go to the same high school anymore. But see, the story is told from Kay's point of view, and Kay is another jerk on the platform, so then for the first half or so of the series, it's really hammering home to you how good of a guy Kato is. And Kato is like, I'm the kind of guy who can't let it go. I have to help someone every time.
Right.
So it seems like in a normal show, Kato would be the protagonist, because usually, you know, like Luffy from One Piece, like the protagonist is a good guy, he's chaotic good or whatever, he's helping out all the time, or, you know, Naruto wants what's just and what's best and is taking action to do it, but Kay is not the person who does that. Kato is the person who does that.
Right.
Doesn't Kato almost die in the first incident, too? Like, he's about to die, and then they get beamed back, and he gets his arm back or something? Or was that Kay? And then they discover, like, if you live till just the last minute.
I think that was Kay, but
it's been long enough.
And they succeed in getting this dude out of the tracks. Kay feels obligated to help Kato out because Kato recognizes him.
Right.
Not because he's suddenly
a good person.
He's suddenly a good person.
I think Kay is also recognizes Kato first and is like, oh my God, I hope
right.
he doesn't notice
me. I hope
me.
He doesn't notice me.
Which I think, you know, when I see a coworker on the subway or something like that, I'm like, oh, I don't want to have to talk with him the whole way home.
Right. But this is...
It's life or death.
This is important because Kay feels responsible for this, responsible for helping, because he's been identified as an individual. And he's not just another face in the crowd
right.
that has, plausible deniability. Essentially, or anonymity. So by being recognized, he goes down into the tracks, and they do get the bum out. But before they themselves can escape, they're hit by a train, and their heads go flying.
The express train, and it's not stopping
it's not
at
the
that
local.
Station.
It's not the local.
And they try and outrun it, and
so
it doesn't.
So that really didn't go very well for them. They are then transported into a locked room with a giant sphere. Sitting in the middle of it. And what transpires is...
dog rape.
Kind of like it's... Well, things happened before the dog rape. But there is a kind of story, science fiction story. It's almost like its own little subgenre, just like the locked room mystery is a subgenre.
Oh,
of
yeah, like that
mystery.
One that... I like the one that Osmo was mentioning, where it's like an extreme detective book where there's a series of like 20 locked doors and 10 detectives who have to solve two murders.
Right.
That sounds great. Anyway, go ahead.
Where people show up, usually it's people from different time periods, like warriors from different time periods.
Sweet.
And they don't know what they're doing there.
Like that old episode of Star Trek, and they all land on that planet. I think it's the one with Abraham Lincoln in it that's really awful.
Oh, man. I don't know.
Or there's
I don't
like
remember.
Two episodes like that. There's one with different historical like warlords. And I think there's like someone from... I want to say it's Genghis Khan also shows up in that one, and it's super bad. And it's like an alien who's like, I've gathered all these historical figures.
Precisely. So they can fight, and
right.
we can see who is the biggest badass.
Right, exactly.
And I think that there were elements of that in the most recent Predator film, where they get all those different elite dudes and drop them off on
no
the Predator
idea.
World.
That's what happened.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Do they have it's someone? Like, do they have a Mongolian warrior? Because that's like the best. I want to see
man,
them.
They've got every stereotype in there.
Shooting a
Except
bow and
you may recall
a sweet horse.
Dewey McJewface, who I got called out for calling him Dewey McJewface. He's not actually like a Mossad operative. He's an American CIA.
But you're allowed to call him that because you're Jewish?
No, I'm not allowed to call him that because I'm Jewish. I'm allowed to call him that because, we have freedom of speech
tell
in this country.
Tell the audience which actor you're talking about.
Oh,
I don't remember
the man's
name. He's in Inglorious Bastards and stuff.
I don't usually, watch live action movies anymore.
What are the other movies
he's
in?
Man... I don't know.
I'll just look him up right now.
He was in
Inglourious Basterds, right?
I don't know. I didn't see it.
Okay. Isn't every... Anyway. What's the main movie that he's in?
I think he won an Academy Award for something.
That narrows it down.
Look, we don't watch live action in this house anymore, so I should be forgiven for not knowing.
We watched Moyashimon live action for two
that
episodes.
That doesn't count. There's also CG in there.
Sometimes we watch Tosh.0.
Does that count as live action?
Yeah.
I also haven't watched that in, like, months.
Fuck.
This
My life's a
fault.
Total waste.
Yeah, but this is not to the point. The point is this is kind of a well-established subgenre in science fiction. And so...
The locked room.
Well, the locked room where a bunch of people are, given weapons and then told to hunt someone or hunt each other or, whatever.
The most dangerous game.
Yeah, turns out it's
man.
It's man.
It's you.
Man is the most dangerous game.
It's actually me. Anyway, go ahead.
I was going to say you, but...
Me personally.
Yeah, it is. Aaron is the most dangerous game. But what ends up happening is not... It is perhaps more, I don't know, realistic is certainly the wrong word, but more authentic in that people are very reluctant to take their role in this narrative... seriously.
Right. They really do think it's a reality TV show, which I think having watched reality TV in Japan, they are justified in thinking so. Like,
this could really happen. In fact, I wonder if there hasn't since been like a Gantz
comedy show,
TV show where like
comedians are transported to the room.
Well, it's too soon, right? It's in bad taste.
Yeah.
But they're like, they shake the building and then the lights go out and then there's like, chloroform
oh, shit.
That gets sprayed into a room and everyone in the room thinks that they died, and then all of the Talento come in and like drag them to a different location. Of course, it would be the Talento being dragged to a different location.
Yeah, because they wouldn't do it to regular people. They only torture their comedians for some reason.
Well, it is.
You're like, they have it coming.
Yeah.
But, I like that the first time they're in the room, there's a guy in there who's gone through the game before, and he tells them everything and is a huge D-bag. But he's mostly like, look, there's outfits that are going to pop out of the sphere and these guns, and we're going to have to wear the crazy outfits and shoot the guns. And everyone's like, I don't know about this. Let's try the door. He's like, forget it. You can't touch the door. It's fucking locked. There's no way out. Trust me. And if you walk too far away, you'll explode. But then on subsequent times when they're in the room, it's very frustrating to watch because the other strangers are all equally as flustered, where they're like, what is this, some freaky cosplay thing? I'm not putting on this freaky leather suit.
Right. And eventually,
that's a very genuine reaction.
After the veteran gets offed,
right.
It's Kay who ends up in that role.
And he's not very convincing or charming. And he's like, if only Kato was here telling them this at one point. He's like, I'm really bad at explaining this stuff.
The difference is, though, that D-bag, what he says at one point is,
don't you secretly want to look at a dead body? Don't we all want to secretly kill someone? And everyone's like, no, what? And that guy's like, because I do it, and this is awesome.
Well, that's not what I was thinking
of. I can't wait to play this game.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
What I was thinking of is, he says, it's actually better for me if I don't tell you guys anything.
Because it's funnier?
Because he gets more points.
Oh, right.
Because this is, in fact, a game.
Right.
The Black Sphere, Gantz, has set this up so that these people are being forced to play a violent game.
I wish it was more of a direct parody of like the gaming industry, where the Gantz Sphere is telling them things like, and now you must pay $12.99 a month. If you want to kill the alien, that's additional content, and you have to pay. Or you have to watch this ad. It's an ad-based game. They're like, oh, this sucks. Buy an extra controller to play the next stage.
Oh, man.
Sorry, I'm complaining about my PS3. Go ahead.
So he doesn't have a very good outlook on life, the veteran.
Yeah. Bit of a negative Nelly.
Right, a bit of a negative Nelly.
Just wanted to use soft
hands. So he gets killed.
I don't think he gets killed in the second one, does he? Or
he gets killed in the second
game. Because with the Birdman.
So the first game,
right?
They have to hunt down the onion head alien.
He really likes onions.
And that's his catchphrase.
It's the troubling thing is, it's an alien kid, and they're like, oh, I don't know, it's just a kid. Like, can we kill someone who looks like a human child, but it's an alien who likes onions? And so everyone's waffling about killing him. Till his dad shows up. He's like 7 feet tall and crushing people's heads with his hand.
Right. Well, by that time, they have killed the child.
Right.
Because what else are they going to do?
They feel forced, and when they leave the area, their heads do explode. I don't think everyone knows that. It's very...
Oh, yes. Well, you don't have the option of not playing this game.
Right.
You can hide, and I guess there is one character, which now maybe that's the reason for that dog. Who knows what this dog did to become part of the game?
I don't know. He gets killed eventually.
He does get killed eventually, but...
He does get 0 points.
Gantz is always...
Oh, no. Remember, we found out the point of the dog. Because when the suicide girl shows up, and she's nude, and she just killed herself in a bath, the dog starts licking her crotch right away. And everyone is like, this is the part that really disturbed me, and that's why I didn't read any more Gantz or watch any more Gantz initially, after when it first came out. It was because it was really disturbing to have cross-species rape in that way. And everyone keeps remarking, like, oh, the dog must have belonged to a lonely housewife, and that's their excuse for why this dog is trying to, like...
Ha ha, lols.
Right. So, but it's not just that it happens once, it keeps happening.
Yeah.
And she keeps being, like, even the second time they play, it happens again. Like, it's so annoying and ridiculous. But I think we do event, like, the other people who are transported to the room, the really bad people try to rape the girl too. They're like,
immediately.
It's just immediately. And I think that the point of the dog is to show you that these people are no better than the dog. The dog is going on its basest instinct towards the naked girl, and so are the worst people in the room. Like the Yakuza dude, the other, like, really crazy extra crazy people, they are immediately drawn to also try and rape the girl. And
right.
I think it's drawing that parallel. Like, what makes us civilized or slightly better than animals is that we don't immediately try and rape naked women.
Well, I'd agree with that point.
It's just like being, but it's being thrown in your face in a way that's so inelegant that
I don't.
It's
well,
hard
that, that's why I don't. There's something else there, because that dog is not.
The dog is only there to survive through the first couple parts of the game, and I think when they're finally up against a really bad, like aliens who are extremely hostile, then the dog gets killed too. Like,
yes.
It was only trying to survive, didn't get any points in the game. Eventually, it couldn't survive. And I think the point of the dog was made by then, and so they just killed it off, frankly. That's what I thought.
Hmm.
What were you going to say?
Well, I'm still not entirely certain, because...
How did it get in its suit? That's my question.
That's also a good question. Maybe someone helped it out.
Too,
the
yeah.
dog does have a little suit. That dog is not... It's not like... A mean, aggressive dog.
No, it's like a kind of friendly. Just,
yeah, friendly, cute dog. And it's only aggressive when it's
cornered.
Going for no.
Oh.
It doesn't become aggressive, so far as I remember.
Did it growl at someone at one point?
Maybe.
I think it knew there was danger at some point and growled, but not in a way that seemed threatening to humans.
Right.
Anyway.
So they kill the Onion Head alien, and then the Onion Head's father comes home, and there's a bit of a, I don't know,
a
more dangerous, higher fatality combat ensues.
More limb loss.
Yeah, there is.
A lot of limb loss in this show. I'm going to say more limb loss. Maybe, I've never seen Saving Private Ryan, but I heard there's a lot of limb loss in the first
there, there's, yes.
We're talking about that level of limb loss.
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah.
So, they're transported back to their room. They get to...
Like, they get a couple episodes in the regular world.
Leave.
When they sell their suits.
Yeah.
I think Ichiro Itano is the director who is known for Missile Trails, and he directed the anime. Anyway, he was careful to say in the DVD interview that they made a big point to show their everyday life after the first game. Like, they spent a lot of time on those episodes to show things unfolding, to show what the people are regularly like. And I think, like, so those episodes are important, although they seem kind of boring and after the fact?
Well, no, I get it entirely. Because when something violent and horrible happens to you, you still have to exist in the regular world.
Yeah, he still starts going to school the next day.
Which seems kind of strange.
Yeah.
But that's true. That's what happens.
Yeah, you still have to wake up.
You know, I got, I don't know, is my mom going to listen to this show?
I don't know.
I shouldn't say
she
anything.
Sometimes listens to it. I don't know if she pays attention.
Yeah, I'm sure she would pay attention immediately. All right, delete this part.
Okay. Let me save the file.
Go ahead.
All right, go ahead.
So when something horrible, frightening, violent happens to you, you're still trying to process it for several days. And so as you obsess over this thing that's happened to you, the world around you continues on as normal.
Right, whether it's something like a bad breakup or September 11th.
Right.
The world kind of goes on. You're kind of surprised that...
And it was very strange because after and during and on September 11th, there were pockets of normality around New York, and it was very strange to experience that.
Yeah.
I remember as I was walking back from Columbia, maybe?
Yeah.
that there was like this firefighter covered in soot and sitting on the front of on the steps in front of a bodega, and he was crying. And then walking by him, there was this gaggle of girls who were bar hopping as if nothing had happened.
Good day for it.
And it's a slightly different, that's a slightly different situation than what's being dealt with in Gantz, because of course,
it's only happened to like
those girls were in denial. Those girls were doing what they've always done because they didn't know what else to do.
Or maybe they never do that. I don't know. But yeah, in Gantz, it's just the characters that it happens to, so it's more
right. So
personal.
they are
so they've
isolated.
Suffered a, yeah, a really traumatic. And they also are, it's important that they're forbidden from talking about it. And made clear that if they talk about the Gantz game, like, their heads will explode or whatever.
And indeed, when later one of the participants utters it in real life, his head explodes.
Yeah.
So it's no joke.
Like, he accidentally says it or something and
right.
Bam, that's it for him.
Right.
Really high death toll in this series, which I think I also complained about in my review, that it's like when you watch a disaster horror movie, a disaster movie or horror movie, or one of those survival horror movies.
Yeah.
where, like, there's a huge ensemble cast, and you know most of the cast can die off probably pretty fast, so you really don't want to, you don't really get attached to them, and also, like, you just don't, they're not around long enough, and it's always, like, a bunch of people from different walks of life, and that happens in Gantz, too, where it's, I want to say it's, like, Gilligan's Island, where the rich couple, and a weird professor, and Ginger and Marianne, and whatever, like, kind of random people.
Right, except if it was Gilligan's Island, then, like, they'd show up and Gilligan would be like, all right, so this palm tree is going to explode and there's going to be a bunch of weapons and we're going to have to fight an alien. And then everyone would die except Gilligan. And then another bunch of shipwrecked people would wash up and be like, all right, you're not going to believe this, but... Right.
I like it if someone other than Gilligan's... I never really liked Gilligan himself. I always hoped the other characters would... Anyway.
No comment.
Go ahead.
So... Now the people who have been involved in the game that survived the first round, those people being the veteran who we mentioned before, Kay, Kato, and this suicidal girl.
Whose name is also
Whose name is also Kay.
Oh, but it turns out there's a problem with Gantz's thing, and, like, sometimes it doesn't exactly replicate your body at the moment of death, or it's a weird, busted machine. So although she killed herself, she wasn't all the way dead, and her... slit wrist body wakes up in the hospital, so she can't go home to her parents' house because there's another her still alive.
Yep.
That's kind of awkward. So she lives with the other Kay, and even though she's in love with Kato, she shows up at Kay's door and is like, have you ever thought of keeping a pet? Can I be your pet? But also, I can't sleep with you because I'm crying too often. And he's, of course, like, being a super pervert who carries pornography to class.
Except, right, he's not a super pervert.
He's just a regular young
man. It's interesting how that's addressed. He certainly feels like a super pervert. And maybe in Japan, there's more of...
Or maybe the word doesn't translate that well. I've complained about that before.
No, because consider, the very first scene, he's in the classroom.
Right.
Right?
He's looking at porn or something. Or
He's imagining the teacher naked.
Right.
And then he looks around the room to discover that all of his classmates are naked.
Right.
And then someone notices that he's got an erection.
Right. And they're like, hey, teacher.
Hey, teacher.
He's got a boner.
So.
I was saying there's a movie called Pecker from, like, 2000 or something. And that should be, like, his nickname from then on. Pecker.
So he, even though that is something that adolescent boys do.
It's excessively cruel of his class to offend
you. It's excessively cruel, but it demonstrates how... Just having these feelings and expressing them.
Something that totally normal, if you are an adolescent boy, right. Happens all the time.
Even if it's involuntary.
Yeah.
And it is, it's very funny, because he's looking around and it's not like he's leering at his female classmates. It's like his mind spontaneously has removed their clothing. He's very surprised to see that he is sitting in a classroom where all the girls are naked.
Right.
And so... It's involuntary. It's his, you know, his thoughts. Right.
It's not even his fault.
It's not
that he got a boner.
An action.
Right.
And yet he's
called
ridiculed
out.
For
yeah.
it. So this is one of the few instances in anime that I can think of where I really do have a lot of sympathy for this character in that fashion.
Yeah.
Because he's got this girl. Who's going to be staying with him.
Right. And he's like, oh my God, a real live girl
right.
is going to be sleeping in my bed because I don't have a sleeping bag and I live in a tiny apartment by myself or whatever. And she does offer to be his pet. And so he's like, when is the part when we make out?
Right. And it's really...
They start to, but then she's crying too much about being, you know, suicidal in
yeah,
the dance game.
Kind of ruins the atmosphere.
Yeah.
But there's a scene where... They're both in bed, and he's trying to get this across. So I don't remember exactly how it's translated, but it's essentially like, okay,
when do we
have sex? And that is a far more authentic way to address this than I think I've seen anywhere else in anime where you have these awkward... circumstances.
Well, being Japanese, he should know after she takes a shower. I think she did take a shower.
And she did take a shower.
Okay.
Right.
Which is something I didn't notice until I think I read about it somewhere else. That like
no, it wasn't until Japanese our friend
people,
Carrie told
you. Yeah, she told us that Japanese people always shower before sex. I don't. They are just really sticklers about germs.
I think it's probably less being a stickler for germs than being demonstrating that is their intention.
I think Americans shower after sex.
Right.
Sometimes.
But I'm saying that when they go take a shower,
then you know for sure they're going to sleep with you.
Right.
Unless their clothes were all ruined by some crazy thing that just happened, and they're just using your shower. But then you're really confused. You're like, it could be because when that taxi went by and stained all her clothes with mud, she really did need to take a shower. But at the same time, she's showering in my apartment. So does this mean she wants to have sex with me?
I don't think that actually ever happens.
Probably not.
I mean, it certainly happens that girls are put in compromising positions where they have to take showers. But no one ever mistakes that for being a come-on. It's also the case that if a girl gets in your car,
she's going to sleep with you.
Yeah, she's going to have sex with you.
So don't get in cars.
Or so we are led to believe by...
if you're a Japanese person... Oh, if you're like a Western person and you're making a trip to Japan and someone pulls up in a car, don't get in the car unless you intend to sleep with them. As we've discovered from such sources as Peach Girl... That is the leading cause of date rape in Japan.
Is getting in someone's car.
Not even date someone you're dating. It's just really
well,
in a car. Never
rape,
get in a car with anyone.
Date rape in...
This comes up in Honey and Clover as
in
well.
In manga and anime.
Yeah. Don't get in the car.
But if manga and anime were an accurate depiction of Japan, everyone's parents would have died in the same car accident.
Like half the population would be orphans.
Yeah. The highest cause of death would be car accidents.
Right. Exactly. Hands down.
And... every teen would be living on their own,
right?
I think
75% of Japanese teenagers live without their parents, and like over 40% of parents who aren't dead work abroad.
Oh yeah,
or in another
that
town.
Too.
We should give like a fake statistic sheet about Japan's problems based on anime and manga.
So
girls living in the same house is breaking all kinds of tenant laws.
There's this, so there's a great deal of sexual tension there. Not the good kind of mutual sexual tension, but the bad kind
of one-sided,
potentially predatory sexual tension. And he's trying to deal with it as best he can.
Yeah.
But adolescent boys...
they're interested in sex.
They're interested in sex. It's difficult.
It's on their mind.
Right. So one of the things that the director mentions in the commentary is how the... whoever
this is important.
TV station.
We watched the DVD version, and
yes.
The director explains, Itano explains that when Gantz aired on Japanese TV, a lot of the gorier scenes were cut, but also they made a bunch of insane requirements, like when there's a biker gang, they all have to be wearing helmets, or like different things like that, which sort of like, they're a biker gang, they're already outlaws, like... they're not wearing helmets. That's just realistic. And they're like, no, because of safety reasons or whatever, they have to make them wear helmets. And so, like, when they went back into the DVD version, they did things like took the helmets off, showed all the gore,
right,
extended some scenes. And he makes a really great point that he doesn't, and he speaks very frankly, which is, and it seems like he's really being honest, which doesn't usually happen in DVD commentaries,
yeah,
where he says, like, I think it's wrong that we're censoring this way. I think we're just following what America does, and I don't think... that's right. I think that, you know, we should think for ourselves what should be censored and not, or, you know, if at all, and not just like blindly kind of imitate what another country is doing in their media. And he's right. Americans do self-censor a lot of their cartoons. Like I watched it on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. They're supposed to be Ninja Turtles that, you know, do a lot of like martial arts fighting. And by the time it got to the season that we were working on, the network changed and the new network had different kinds of violence specifications. And they were like, let's not show any kicks directly to the chest. Like, stuff like that. Like, no headshots ever. Like, it was extremely restricted as to what kind of violence that we could show on television. And it's not like the network was breathing down our neck. It was like, internally, we would censor at one level. And then we would show it to the network censors who would then say, like, let's tone down this or that. And before it ever got to, like, any kind of... it's not like there was, like, an FCC regulation or, you know, like, there was a lot of... before the fact kind of censoring. Anyway, but that kind of culture of censorship apparently just being exported.
A couple of things here,
yeah.
Because censorship in America and censorship in Japan, different things in as much as when American cartoons are censored, It's for liability reasons.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Part of it is they don't want parents calling in and complaining that there's adult content. But
right.
the more important, the more effective reason is that they don't want anyone to sue when their kid kicks someone in the chest and says they learned it by watching Ninja Turtles.
Right.
That's not a problem you have in Japan.
I think that's why in Avatar The Last Airbender, they have this entire martial arts where nobody touches each other. They just hurl big energy weapons. I guess that happens in Dragon Ball Z, too, where if you say Hamehameha and aim it at someone, you're imitating television, but you're not kicking your fourth grade.
I guess that's true, but there's an awful lot of punching.
There is in Dragon Ball. Yeah, it's not a very good example. But yeah. I'm saying whenever you have people doing energy weapons, that's fine for children to imitate.
I guess I'd never thought of that before, and that's true.
Until they channel their ki, and then it's better for you.
But in Japan, I think it has more to do with the kind of culture that they want to portray.
Yeah.
Right? And it's true, the director did say all of those things, but I don't think he was necessarily making a freedom of speech argument. I think he was saying specifically that these things are happening in the world. These things being...
They exist in the world.
Yeah. You know, those gory explosions, and later in the series, it's in the text, talking specifically about Iraq and Afghanistan and the people being destroyed in IEDs. It's exactly what it looks like in Gantz, these people who are losing their limbs. You know, this stuff exists. Mm. And the director's point was, how can we... If we're not willing to show it on television, how can we address it as a society? And I think that's correct. I think that that's the right attitude to have. And that's why Gantz isn't like over the top, and it isn't exploitative in a way that maybe even Fist of the North Star is. Because it is trying not merely to be sensationalistic, but it is trying to address the reality of the 21st century, where we now have such a media-centric society,
yeah,
that we can see all of these things. We can see, you know, people exploding in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's beneficial.
I don't think the news shows that.
No, but you can watch it on YouTube. It's available. You can see it.
Okay.
And to really understand the world, and Gantz, as we'll get into a little bit later, it's all about seeing things from someone else's perspective. That in order to have a better understanding of the world, and in order for the world to actually become better, you have to have these experiences by proxy and sort of vicariously, which is what happens when we watch. When you watch anything, when you watch violent media,
I listen to some.
You're having a vicarious experience.
There was some like TED Talk or something. They have a podcast where this guy was saying that in brain scans, when they scan the brain of someone watching a video of someone else doing something, like those parts of your brain kind of activate.
Yeah, mirror neurons.
Like that's kind of nuts, though. Like that means if you watch a lot of violent acts or play a lot of violent video games, then your brain really is activating parts of it.
It's activating, and just a brief digression since you brought this up. So mirror neurons, very cool. It turns out that, yes, when you watch someone, your brain is mimicking what you see them doing.
Right, which makes sense in, like, an exercise class or, like, a dance class. When you see the instructor do it, and then you're able to, like, imitate it.
It makes sense in an exercise class, but not in practically every other circumstance.
Right, it seems kind of crazy.
Because...
Well, if you watched, like, a cooking show on TV, one
right.
hopes you could,
there,
like,
there are instances where we do want to reproduce what we see.
Right.
But
way more where we
99%
don't.
of the time.
That's
so,
true.
In fact, there are other parts of the brain that suppress those signals. And what they are discovering is that there are actually two, let me see if I have this right. There are two sets of mirror neurons, two types. One that identifies what someone else is doing, and another that is identifying your relation to that person,
Whoa.
To where you are,
okay.
and how you could copy their movements.
Huh.
In autistic children, half of that signal is suppressed.
Oh.
So
they can't tell if they're the ones doing it or not?
Right.
Ooh.
So when they look at brain scans of autistic kids,
yeah,
they see that there's no activity in one of those suppression centers.
Oh.
So
that would be a problem for you.
That's a problem.
I think you said that your mirror neurons don't work because you see someone else do something and then you can't imitate it that well.
Right. Well, I'm very bad at exercise classes, and I'm very bad at being shown
how to do something.
When Aaron's dad tried to teach me how to shoot pool, it makes me get very angry because I have a very difficult time reproducing what other people do. However, it turns out now, potentially, that those mirror neurons also have to do with empathy and activating empathy.
Oh, but you're very empathetic.
Right. So what's the deal, man?
You feel bad for the pool cube. I don't know.
I don't know.
But it's weird because when I played pool with my dad, and that's the only way I enjoy playing pool, is because he's always like, okay, aim here on the cue ball, and it's going to knock that into there. And so I'm like, okay. And then I aim there, and then it works the way he says. I don't like playing pool with anyone else because I can't figure out where to shoot at all. I'm really just bad with physics and strategy in any kind
of... Yeah, well, pool's probably not your game.
Nope. Then. I hate it. And I'm really competitive, so then I get really upset when I lose really badly at something. So just never go bowling with me, ever.
Well, you never want to go bowling with anyone
else.
You're right. You hate bowling.
I had to quit. It was too painful.
Right.
Okay, so mirror neurons and watching people. So when we watch Gantz, some of those mirror neurons are firing, but fortunately other ones are suppressing those things. Oh, I want to make a point about the lie of, okay, Sam Fuller, I think, was a film director and directed a bunch of war films.
Sure.
And Quentin Tarantino did a really great documentary about him that's worth watching because Sam Fuller's crazy and kind of really energetic. And he said something about violence on film where he had been in World War II. He's a very old man. And said, like, all war films are lies. We lie in every war film. And it's because, like, in a war film, you know, a bomb goes off and then they carry a body away in a stretcher. I mean, he's talking about, you know, pre-Saving Private Ryan or whatever. He's like, what actually happens in wars? A bomb goes off and you can't even find all the parts of the guy. You find, like, a hand, a belt buckle, his nuts or something, because he's very visceral. He talks, you put those together and you're like, I guess these were his. And then you walk away. Like,
right.
It's that sort of visceral experience. I think they used to show more bodies on the news during Vietnam.
Certainly they did, yes.
Then they stopped because it was crushing the morale of the American people.
Now they don't do it. Because if everyone got to experience how bad war is...
It meant that, like, that would lead to the other side winning because they would no longer have the will to fight the war.
That's correct.
So they're very
strict.
I'm saying
that if everyone got to experience... how bad war is.
Nobody would actually become a soldier.
Nobody would want to fight. Unfortunately, and this gets addressed later on.
Yeah.
That's not true.
There are some people who are drawn to that.
There are some people who are drawn to that.
Right.
That's the other thing I was going to say about all those violence on TV studies.
Yeah.
About whether or not they inspire violence in children.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're doing those again with better technology. Again, looking at brain activity. And it turns out...
Totally does.
Well, that's just it. It's not that easy.
Oh.
In most people,
yeah,
it does not.
Right.
In those kids...
Like that 1%.
Who have a tendency for violence already,
yeah,
it does make them more violent.
Right.
So...
Those kids need to stop watching TV.
Those kids, right.
But
those kids who have a proclivity for violence,
shouldn't watch.
They are made more violent by that kind of programming.
Right. And they were already dangerous to begin with, so that's not good.
So that's not good.
Right. Violence and television. I think it's the final arc of Gantz that has the super crazy people.
Right. Well, they are set up ahead of time, but there are two sociopaths who are encountered during the third game.
Right.
And these are people who are just predators. They prey on the homeless. They beat people up. They kill people.
Right.
For fun.
Yeah. But they're really important characters. And I think if they were included in an earlier arc, a lot of people had my experience with Gantz where they watched the first episode or two and then turn it off threw away the disc, sent it back to Netflix,
right?
Or left that room of the anime convention because it was just like, it's just too much, and it's also throwing it in your face that you're supposed to like it, or that you like that kind of thing, and you're a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were done with the show because it looked like it was, you know, a teenage, you know, dream or whatever, and not, and also telling you you're bad, and also like being a spectacle. But at the end, there is a political message that they make with these guys. I mean, it's not political. Well,
it's a moral and philosophical message.
But it gets a little bit, the way they handle it, I think, is because the protagonist fighting the guy, and it becomes very like speechy, like they're struggling like in a hand-to-hand combat situation, and then giving long like philosophical speech.
Well, it's,
but they're kind of addressing the point directly at that, and it's not an elegant way to do it. I don't like it when.
Well, so says Aaron. It didn't bother me because I was glad to see it addressed in such a pedantic way.
I mean,
almost.
I'm so glad they made the point and they were very clear
lost.
About it.
But to back up, you have these two, thrill killers.
Yeah.
And eventually they get offed and end up in the room with Gantz themselves. And in that final game where only Kay has survived, so Kay's love interest, both of them, are dead. Kato is dead. And Kay is the only one who has survived. And so in this game, Kay is the target.
Right. Gantz is like, okay, everyone kill this dude. He's dangerous. Kill Kay.
And this is how Gantz is operating. Gosh, what did I... I know when we talked about this before, I had some
fancy word.
Good way of putting it. Yeah.
I don't know. I got to go to the bathroom.
Okay. I'll think about it while you do that.
Go.
All right, well, Kay has made the target in the final game, and in a way, it has then come full circle. Now, when in the first game, they had to hunt an alien,
mm-hmm.
It's like hunting a video game sprite. Mm. No, it's completely depersonalized, and even comes with his own little catchphrase.
Oh yeah,
right.
I like onions.
Yeah.
The other one has a catchphrase too, isn't he? But then Kay has a catchphrase.
They all have a catchphrase, yeah.
Yeah.
And so suddenly Kay finds himself in the position that the alien was.
Because they don't know if the aliens are like bad or what they did or why they should kill them. And so the characters tend to struggle morally with it.
As well they should.
Right. They struggle with killing Kay too. Because one of the people is now his teacher. From class.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't go very well for her.
No.
But they are...
She's like, I never liked you, Kay. This doesn't mean I want to kill you. What?
Yeah, it's strange. It's strange that she shows up because she's the one who's been in an illicit affair.
Yeah.
The people who pop up in these rooms, they're either bad people or apathetic people, generally.
Yeah.
Kato's not.
Just except
he's a good guy.
Okay. Well, what about the suicide girl? She's just really depressed.
Right, well,
doesn't make her a bad person. It means she has
Does it make her apathetic?
A serious problem. Apathetic about, I don't know, her life? Anyway.
Yeah.
I think all the other people have a moral issue or something. It's for that kid. People around him were failing him. There's like a little kid who's like really spoiled, and his grandmother who ended up in the room. But the kid is spoiled because the grandmother spoils him.
Right.
So, I don't know if that kid has it coming.
Well, Gantz must have felt.
So?
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway.
So, the thrust of the final arc is that Kay has to convince people that, in fact, he despite the fact that Gantz is telling them that he is the enemy, he's not the enemy. The enemy is actually these two dudes who are killers.
Right.
And how that comes to pass, there's a lot of give and take between the other people in the room. But ultimately, Kay finds himself in a standoff with the crazier of the two killers.
Mm.
And the dude makes the argument, essentially, look, society made me this way.
Right. Society's to blame.
I have, and he gives some small amount of background on his horrible existence.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
And how does that make him any different from those guys who are out fighting in Iraq.
In Iraq, yeah.
And he mentions Iraq specifically.
Yeah. And Gantz is from a few years ago, so it would have been...
Yeah. And Kay realizes that there's actually a big difference.
Right.
That...
And this is like the main point.
Yeah.
For us, is the moral code.
We can't deny that violence exists because there are horrible psychopaths out there who insist on committing it.
Right.
We can't be apathetic to it because it just leads to more bloodshed.
Mm.
So we have no choice but to rely on a certain amount of violence.
Mm.
And Kay himself, he avoids killing anyone. He kills aliens and monsters after they've shown that they are aggressive.
Yeah.
Right? But he refrains from killing any humans, no matter how many times they've pointed a gun at him.
Right.
No matter how many times they've threatened his life. He refrains from killing anyone.
But now he's in a position where he needs to kill this guy.
He needs to kill this guy, but he doesn't. Instead, he imprisons him because there is a way to modify the gun such that...
One of the guns has the thing that seems like it's beaming them to a prison or something.
Right.
Well, it has like a net.
It's at no point is it called a prison or anything.
Yeah.
It just beams them up.
Right.
They go flying up into space. And this is one of the two ways that you can deal with the aliens that are being hunted.
Yeah.
You can kill them, or you can neutralize them by sending them away. It's kind of like exile. And so the point that Kay makes is, you know, I had no choice but to use violence to subdue you, and now that you're subdued, I'm going to incarcerate you.
Mm.
And because of that, Kay is then sort of transported by Gantz back to that train tunnel where he is now, all of the people on the train platforms, or all the people on the train platform who, incidentally, or really not incidentally, who...
It turns out,
were all people...
Playing the Gantz game.
That is to say, the people on the platform eventually end up playing in the game.
One at a time, yeah. And you didn't realize it was the people on the platform until...
Right.
At the end. Or until, like, towards the end, they start to reveal, like, oh, I was there on that platform, and the two boys disappeared. And then you start to think, like, oh, has it always been all of the people from that platform?
Right.
Which is, like, major spoiler for the ending. But,
so he is given the chance to, or I guess at that point, because now he's running and he's going to outrun the train. And everyone who was standing there apathetically, they're now cheering him on. Because
I didn't think he'd outrun the train. I thought he was just going to regular die.
Well, maybe he'll just regular die. You don't see it, and ultimately it's unimportant, because what's important is Gantz leaves.
Leaves the planet.
And that strikes me very much like a Sodom and Gomorrah story where...
Looking for one righteous dude.
Yeah, one person who... Just one average guy who is... morally upright.
Yeah.
And of course, Kay wasn't morally upright at the beginning of the series, but through an enormous amount of pain and loss and being constantly bombarded by other people's perspectives.
Yeah.
As everyone tries to suss their way out of these moral quandaries, he becomes a righteous person who understands some, you know, very important realities about the world.
Mm.
And so Gantz leaves.
Yeah. I was like, spoilers for the third, The Girl with the Blue Eye, which is also in a series that's been out for a while. In the final arc of that, there's a presence on the planet that's an alien presence that's always been watching the Earth, and it's kind of this timeless being that's going to determine whether or not the Earth is worth saving or if it should totally be destroyed. And the alien thing figures out that, like, the girl, the third, the girl with the blue eye, she's worth it, that the planet can be saved, and then it leaves the planet because its mission is fulfilled.
And that ending is shenanigans because Kato, and this is, I think, why Kato dies,
yeah,
and why Kato is not our protagonist. The point is not that there's some...
There was one person.
There's some random mutation out there who's a paladin.
Yeah.
And is completely morally righteous and always does the right thing. It's that someone is able to learn, that these people can be taught.
Right. Which is that's a really positive message for a series that starts off seeming super pessimistic, like showing you the worst of humanity.
Yeah, the absolute worst, the dregs of humanity.
It doesn't look like it was going to, it didn't look like it was going to go in that direction for a long time. I think partway through the arc with they're fighting the statues.
Mm-hmm. That's the third game.
Yeah, it starts to take more of a positive kind of swing. It gets more positive kind of early on. But, like, there's a while when it's sort of, like, unrelentingly, like, humans are bad, everyone's bad, even the good people are going to die. Like, everything's horrible. And you're horrible for watching this.
And like, you, the viewer, are also
you're
horrible.
You're also horrible, right. Which is why I hated the last episode of Seinfeld, because it's, like, punishing you for liking the show.
Right.
Where they're like, these are actually horrible people and you're a bad person for laughing at them. Like, I really enjoyed, like, the second to last episode of Seinfeld a lot more, because it was very Seinfeld-y. Seinfeld episode on a large scale. I think something about a parade. I don't really remember. But I remember, like, the last episode, I never thought the characters in Seinfeld were bad people.
Yeah.
Because I was so used to jerks. So, yeah. That's because, I don't know, something. Anyway, so I thought it was kind of like a slap in the face for the last episode. Also, I would like to say that my experience living in New York City, because the last episode of Seinfeld came out before I moved here, living here, like, that gives it perpetuates a bad stereotype about New Yorkers as people who stand by while bad things happen and don't like interfere. And I don't know what it was like in the 70s when everyone was being mugged like all the time. Maybe that was true, that people just didn't get involved in stuff. But way more often have I had it where like I've seen someone like many times trip on the subway stairs, like totally fall and their purse flies out everywhere, and like a lot of people help them. Like, I rarely see something where someone is in peril and nobody on the if there are people on the street, they tend to stop and they ask if you're okay. Like, I fell on a slippery sidewalk a couple of weeks ago and like five people were like, are you okay? And were checking to make sure I was okay and helping me up.
Right.
So I think New York gets a bad rap as people who are rude and apathetic in that way. But in general, people are helpful when the situation requires it. And there are so many people that, like, not everyone needs to help. And if too many people are calling the cops on their cell phone at once, that's actually, like, not helping the situation. But in my experience, like, we do put on this face where we're walking forward and not paying attention or whatever. But pedestrians are hyper aware of their surroundings all the time. And when something is amiss, people will.
Right. And it's true that we certainly walk past
homeless people.
Homeless people. People marinating in their own filth on a daily basis and ignore them. But if one of those people were to fall in the tracks, I have absolutely no doubt that people, at the very least,
would
call
the
station
attendant. Right, which is something people in Gantz aren't doing. They're all asking if the other person, hasn't anyone called the station attendant yet? Like,
right.
That comes up and nobody has done it.
Right.
I actually saw a guy who was drunk, but not homeless, probably, based on the way he was dressed. I came home from work and there was someone who it looked like, because we live on a subway station it's above ground when it gets to our place. There was a guy who, like, and I've seen it happen a couple times, where because you can't transfer from one direction to the other at this station, I've seen particularly drunk or daring people, always men, jump down on the tracks to run across the tracks and jump up onto the other platform to go the other way, instead of trying to go out and tell the person they already paid and whatever and getting a proper transfer. This only happens late at night on a weekend or something. Someone looked like they were doing that. Like, a guy jumped down into the tracks in that way, like, I'm going to now transfer to the other side. But he didn't. Instead, he fell through. Like, not all at once. Like, it seemed like he was getting onto the tracks himself, like, lowering himself down. And then he slipped or something and ended up on the street. But a clump of people who were getting off the train that he had also gotten off of, like, so we're all exiting the station. Lots of people were like, whoa, oh my gosh, are you okay? And at first, it wasn't clear, like, was it an accident? Was he trying to kill himself? What was the deal? But as I was walking past it, it was obvious that he was, like, shit-faced drunk, like, blind drunk. But he looked like he was trying to transfer that way. Anyway, my point is, like, five people were helping out this guy. Yeah. I have a new credit union message alert.
All right, that's not important.
All right.
Now, it's difficult because I tend to be the guy who tries to help.
Yeah, where you can't let it go.
And
I'm always worried he's going to get stabbed.
Right.
By interfering.
I haven't been stabbed yet.
Not yet. I guess it's also like that your dad would give homeless dudes rides downtown to the hospital.
Yeah.
That's clearly
where I get it from, because my mother will have nothing to do. She's very proud of her status as a liberal.
Yeah.
Because to her that means that we shouldn't have to worry about it. That's what we pay the government for.
Oh, I see.
And she says it just like that.
But your dad had like the opposite.
Yes, my dad had the opposite standpoint.
Let's not pay the government for that, and I will individually help out crazy drug users who need a ride downtown.
Right.
And he did, and was never once stabbed.
Nope. The end.
Instead, he died of pancreas cancer, like everyone else.
Pancreatic cancer. But I. Well, so when I don't help, because there have certainly been times when I have felt like I should do something and don't, I still think about those times now.
Oh, you still regret it?
Like when I was in college coming back on the bus from LaGuardia and I was exhausted from having flown in from Denver and going back. I guess I wasn't, this was after college, this was about 1999, 2000, something like that. And there was this woman who kept slapping her kid on the bus really hard. Jeez. And like he was all bruised up and everything.
Ooh.
And I did nothing. And as a result, completely unbidden sometimes, that image will come in my mind.
Mm.
It will percolate from my subconscious. And, you know, I can't go back. I can't return to that and intervene.
Mm.
And there are people falling all over themselves to say, well, it's just as well, because if you do intervene, the only thing that's going to happen is she's going to take that kid home and take it out on him even worse. Mm. That might be true. I don't know. But
like, what would you even say? Would you say to the kid, like, what your mom's doing is wrong, and yell at the lady?
Yeah, I would.
I think it's important for the kid to know in that situation, too, that, like, this isn't normal. And
well,
it's not your fault.
At the very least, that is what I would hope would happen, is that even if she does then continue to, you know, beat the crap out of him, over which I have no control when, you know, they go home or whatever, at least the kid will know that someone at one point did stand up for him, for what that's worth. And I, you know, what would I do? What do I wish I would have done? I wish I would have told her to stop it. You know, and I wish I could have. I would much rather that she's yelling at me than hurting the kid.
Yeah,
but never mind me. I mean, there's also the bus driver there who is nominally the authority.
Yeah,
you know, you do what the bus driver says. He's not doing anything. You know, so would I have called the cops? Probably not. Would I have yelled at her? That's what I wish I would have done. And in subsequent circumstances along those lines, I you know, I have intervened and nothing terrible has come out of it. But now whenever that happens, I really do feel compelled to step in, because otherwise it's going to be on my conscience forever.
Mm. But none of this is like the point that you were making right after we watched Gantz, like when you were like, we have to make a podcast. I mean, we have to do a podcast about Gantz. Because the point you were making was about like the moral code behind war and killing and things like that.
Right.
And how the current generation doesn't think.
Okay, no, that's, yes, certainly. Although I do want to mention also that I had this experience where now, you know, when these things happen, I remember what it was like not to do anything.
Mm.
And I wonder if Gantz itself is a shocking and violent enough series so that if you find yourself in that situation or someone has fallen on the platform or what have you, if you don't think, you know, I must be spurred to action.
Yeah.
So I'm not a bad person, you know? The point that I was making about how I think in in the United States at least, there is a sense that people can't tell the difference. People being, I don't know, the post-war, post-World War II generation really do have a hard time enumerating the differences between a contract killer, for instance, an assassin, and a soldier.
Right.
And how, you know, specifically in the during Vietnam, because the war was handled so unprofessionally, the notion of a code of ethics was blurred because you did have these atrocities taking place, and it, you know, it's an abomination. However,
there is a difference.
There is a difference
between Golgo 13 and an average soldier.
Golgo 13 is not a good example because he's
a contract killer.
He's fictional and
a super soldier.
Right. Type of. He doesn't have to deal with all of the human messiness that one needs to when they have to justify.
I don't know the names of any like real assassins in real life.
Well, good. That's probably just as well.
I don't know.
There's a sense of why don't the way that the logic typically works is one of two ways. You know, why do we intervene? And I guess this is topical because of Libya now. Why do we intervene? Why don't we just leave those people to figure it out for themselves? You know, why don't we just let them work it? They have to work it out for themselves.
Do you think an ounce of intervention saves you 100,000 pounds of refugees later?
Well, I think that you end up with refugees either way. But that perspective is one that suggests that there is agency on both sides of the conflict. That is, you have two opponents that are not asymmetrical, right?
What, the example I just gave?
I don't know what you mean.
You said that position.
Well, the position that we should just let whoever handle it for themselves.
Oh, okay.
You know, we should just let Libya, it's going to work itself out. It doesn't involve us. We should stay out of it.
Clearly everyone was upset when they started firing on the protesters, right?
No, certainly not. Not everyone. Not at least in the area of the blogosphere that I hang out in.
Oh, just the people who I talk to, my coworkers were all, oh my God.
Right.
And like horrified.
Yeah, well, that's a good reaction, but that's not enough of a reaction because it's not enough to simply be horrified.
Right.
You have to then make the decision to intervene.
Well,
if you're going to.
Yeah, if you're a college student, you're not making that decision.
Well, but what I am trying to get across is that to be responsible, one must run themselves through these situations.
Right.
Right? In order to be a responsible citizen, not of any given country, but of any country, you have to be able to think yourself through these scenarios. And if you're aghast, it's not enough to be aghast and throw up your hands. You have to posit some solution.
Mm.
And in engagements like Libya, you know, it's not symmetrical. You have one heavily armed dictator on one side and a populace about to be slaughtered on the other. So, yes, I'm happy that that the international community decided to intervene when they did. But
you're saying like if it's a symmetrical situation, then you don't need to interfere.
Well, yeah, if it's a symmetrical situation, chances are, especially if you have no dog in this fight. If it's the fascists versus the communists, like it was in the Spanish Civil War, whose side do you come in on?
Yeah.
You know, all you can really do is try and provide humanitarian support on the sidelines. But even then, it gets much more morally complex than when you're trying to prevent genocide or outright slaughter.
Okay.
What this has to do with the end of Gantz is that we have a very difficult time because of the narrative that we have built up for ourselves after Vietnam that you can see in a lot of action movies during the 80s, where it holds the hero to such incredibly high standards.
Yeah.
Think of something like Lethal Weapon.
Okay.
Where at the end of the movie, you have what's his face, Hans Gruber, he falls from the top of the tower and dies.
Yeah.
You have that other, the Euro trash terrorist guy.
Yeah.
Right? And they have the opportunity to kill him.
Yeah.
And they don't.
Okay.
It's only after he miraculously comes back to life that it's okay to shoot him. What I'm getting at is there's always this, there's this way of playing these things out where you let the villain, get away. Yeah. You say, you know, I'm not going to kill you.
Yeah.
But then the villain
does something even worse.
Does something. Well, he pulls his knife on you or whatever, and then you have to kill him.
Then you have to kill him. Yeah. Which is like, I'm like, in spoiling even more shows, it was a problem in Avatar The Last Airbender, but I want to say, what is the typical ending of an American action thing or something like that, where it's like what, I like to give the example, like, the bad guy is like falling by no particular action of the hero, for whatever reason, the bad guy is now dangling from the edge of a cliff.
Right.
And the hero offers his hand to help, and the bad guy is a dick about it and tries to pull the hero off the cliff too, at which point it's acceptable for the hero to like let him go and let him drop off the cliff and die. Because it's like, I offered you the hand to let you live and help, but you had to be a dick and try to kill me anyway, and
right.
So now it's acceptable to kill you.
And this does two things.
I think in Fist of the North Star, Kenshiro often gives the opportunity, like, you guys don't have to die.
That's right. That's the difference between Kenshiro and everyone else.
You can run for it. And
except
they usually don't. I think maybe two guys I've seen in like seasons have made a run, have been like, this guy's too strong and run
he
for
says,
it. Everyone else is like, seems good.
Stop it or I'm going to kill you.
Right.
And then they don't stop and then he kills them.
Right.
And that's what separates him from the rest of the villains, is the villains
just kill.
Just kill.
Without warning and
without any
for
kind
no
of justification.
Reason. Yeah, often for fun.
But you put yourself in this situation where it assumes that the hero has so much luck and agency that they are going to be in that position. And that's the kind of...
Well, doesn't Gans do it too, then, if he is in the position to kill the guy, but he uses the prison gun instead? And we don't really... He doesn't outright kill him.
Well, he has the option of imprisoning him, you know.
Okay.
Gans comes down, I think, against the death sentence, you know, the death penalty. I think... That's,
even though he kills so many characters
that's pretty
all the
clear.
Time.
Well, he doesn't kill so many characters. He kills monsters in self-defense.
And people, what, Gantz as the sphere that
you're
is killing
about
people. It. Yeah.
I mean the ethic of the show.
Okay,
not
show
Gantz,
is against the death penalty.
The
freaky alien
whatever it is,
killing
the
people just for not by playing by his rules.
Right.
Yeah, that's
but
all death penalty all the time.
It's not enough because it's not enough in films and in narrative generally, it's not enough to imprison someone. You're going to prison for a long, long time. That leaves it open to a sequel when he busts out.
Yeah.
So you have to somehow reconcile the fact that you're not, that the imprisoned ending is not an acceptable ending.
Mm-hmm.
You have to eliminate the evil. You have to kill the villain.
Okay.
So we do this in this really pussyfoot fashion, whereby the villain is given a chance at redemption, even on having that chance, decides that he's a villain through and through, and tries to, you know, retaliate,
yeah,
and then he gets killed.
Right.
So, again and again, this happens. So, when in New York, this happens not infrequently, by which I mean once every few years, the cops shoot someone who didn't need shooting, who was unarmed. And then there is an enormous outpouring of anger.
Like the time they shot that guy on his wedding day or something?
Yep.
That was bad.
Sean Bell.
Yeah.
And unquestionably, right, we can't have law enforcement going around killing people, even if it's an accident. This is not a societal good.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm often surprised to see that there is no sympathy for a guy who has to make a split-second decision with permanent consequences. So
that nobody sympathizes with, like, the cop.
That I guess so. Or that they don't that they don't see the incident as more complex than they do.
Right.
Now, that's not really what I was talking about in terms of Gantz or in terms of sort of soldiery in the 21st century. The fact of the matter is that after the Second World War, soldiers were able to reintegrate into society with much greater ease
right.
than after any subsequent war. The Korean War might be a notable exception because I don't know how well those veterans were able to be reintegrated. But in the Second World War, it's because they came home and they were treated as heroes, you know, war heroes.
Who fought a just war.
We have since gotten away from that. It makes us very uncomfortable, the idea that anyone could be applauded for killing under any circumstances. Mm. And that's because we have created this narrative for ourselves where in order to fulfill what is necessary to have a viable civilization.
Yeah.
Because as Kay discovers, you must use violence at some level because that's the only way that you are going to adequately deal with people who are simply violent themselves.
Uh-huh.
You know, you don't have the opportunity, you don't have the choice to deal with them in a way.
That's humane. Like, there's no hope that that guy will ever be
right.
reformed. Like, some medication and counseling is not, this guy is such a serial
right.
killing
right.
crazy person. I mean, he's been randomly, indiscriminately killing homeless people with a baseball bat under great violence. This isn't someone who has any hope of turning it around.
Right. So now you have these soldiers who are no longer responsible so much for killing people. In fact, I think you'll find that since about 2007, American soldiers in both theaters of war, they consider inflicting enemy casualties one of the least important things that they do.
Are the most important things like helping build sanitation in the area?
Well, it has more to do with
garbage services.
Yes, it has more to do with, you know, protecting the innocent.
Yeah.
And they don't want to have to kill. They are more like law enforcement than soldiers.
Right.
And that is, you know, that's the Army and the Marines.
Mm.
The Air Force is still, you know, about dropping ordnance on targets. But I feel as though there has not been the necessary cultural shift to acknowledge that fact.
Oh.
That, in fact, the armed forces are now working very hard not to inflict unnecessary casualties. And I don't mean unnecessary casualties like...
Sean Bell.
How they say, what is it? What's the term? The name of a Schwarzenegger movie.
Oh, you're in present danger.
That was a Harrison Ford movie. collateral damage.
Oh.
Not just in terms of reducing collateral damage, which they have also done to a large degree, although they could probably be even better about that. But the idea is to de-escalate and to try and... rather than our previous concept of war, where essentially every war is a war of attrition, whereby you just whoever runs out of resources, whether it's bullets or men or what, whoever runs out of resources loses.
Mm-hmm.
We are now in a position where that's no longer the way the war is
fought
and the war is being considered.
Right.
So...
Is that part of that just because the United States has the most resources and, like, the advanced technology of warfare and, like, the biggest army?
Oh, yes, certainly.
And, like, the most crazy number of nuclear weapons or whatever?
I think that nuclear weapons don't really enter into it, but yes, it's only because the United States has had the opportunity with its military spending that is greater than all other countries put together, has had the opportunity to sit back and really consider... What is the most effective way? Effective meaning what is going to lead to the best outcome? And the best outcome they are rapidly finding is to leave places self-governing rather than, for instance, colonizing them or laying waste to them.
Or instilling a puppet government.
Or, installing a puppet government.
And trying to control them through that way.
Right.
Bad move.
Historically speaking, it has not gone very well.
We go CIA.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's the face of war.
So the distinction between someone like an assassin who is killing for money, mm-hmm. and someone who has very distinct, particular rules of engagement.
Okay.
To limit casualties and to...
Oh, right. That's what you were saying about.
I'm not like a military lawyer or anything, but there's a lot about not following illegal orders.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Hmm.
Where it is your responsibility if you are given an illegal order, that
yeah.
is an order that goes against the
military code?
The military code. Military code of, like, you know, not taking war trophies, not doing. Committing atrocities, you know, so on and so forth,
mm-hmm.
That you must be a thinking individual. You are not merely, a robot taking orders.
Or a hypnotized, brainwashed slave assassin,
right,
as in the case of Phantom, Requiem for the Phantom's Phantom.
Oh, don't even bring that up.
Another show.
And not only is it important, and this is something that the Japanese have a very... thick, at least mythological history with the idea of the samurai code.
Yeah. But in the pop culture, after World War II and manga and things, they weren't allowed to have war comics because the fear was that they would, and Frederick Schott talks about this in his books. They were specifically banned from war stories for a long time because of the fear that of Japanese nationalism, that the horrible nationalism that led them to be aggressors in World War II was specifically not allowed in
right.
post-war comics. And so, like, a lot of things that we see in their pop culture now are, like, you know, just a retelling of a former story or a derivative work of something from a generation ago. But that means that, like, a few generations ago, any kind of story like that wasn't allowed. But then early on in the history of post-World War II manga, there's a point where, like, samurai stories were, like, acceptable again. Mm-hmm. So you could have samurai comics, but you couldn't have, like, war
right.
comics.
Right, that's the kind. Renaissance of samurai film with Kurosawa and
right.
so forth. And that's what happens in a society when you put too much emphasis on the warrior ethic. You get a fiercely authoritarian, nationalistic, fascistic empire. And that's also bad.
Another extreme.
So, yeah, at both extremes, you have... A country, you know, you either have a country who no longer, who believes that it's possible to, believes that it's possible to have civilization without the use of violence.
Okay.
And on the other, a society where, you know, violence is glorified in the name of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to occupy that sweet spot in the middle...
Yeah, to use some violence.
It's to really turn over these questions in your mind and get at the guts of it and stop pretending like it's something that's clinical.
But when you say in your mind, I don't think that's specific enough to explain what you mean. I think that when you say in your mind, in this case, like, it's not enough for, like, your is just like one person. Like,
well,
I think you mean like on the stage or
I mean on the stage
in media.
And I do mean in media.
And you mean like in philosophical discussions or in like editorial pieces or in critical like works or reviews?
All of the above.
In
all of the above.
Right. In like discussions. You mean like in a cultural discussion and or like also in a courtroom?
Well, if you call Gantz a cultural discussion and it is a cultural discussion.
Right. Well, I mean,
it
it's a work
out.
Of media. It's not in your mind. The reason why you're thinking about it in your mind is because you were watching Gantz.
Yes and no.
Okay.
Because it's not just in media. It's in narrative.
Okay.
And narrative allows you to experience these things vicariously.
Right.
And so...
I think that's a premise that you're working from, but I don't think everyone in our audience would be... I wouldn't expect everyone to keep... to have that premise in their mind.
Well, they may not, but they should. And there's an emphasis from Hollywood.
That's like some Joseph Campbell stuff to...
Yes.
It's the hero's journey. The hero experience is a thing that you can vicariously experience without having to take the journey yourself.
Right.
Which is really important in, like, Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Well,
that kind of thing.
It's really important. It's not just of academic importance. It's of societal importance.
Yeah. Like a cultural importance. And but when, yeah, Hollywood...
Hollywood has gotten away from that.
Right.
And has really worked pretty hard to argue that that is not... is not what people want to see.
But there's a trend towards calling spectacle films a popcorn movie. And
right.
You should shut your mind off and experience, like... It's an experience, and it's not a movie that you should think about.
Right.
No one wants to think at the movies except for those freaks who go to Sundance.
Because spectacle is simple.
Right.
Art and narrative, you know, good narrative is complex.
Mm-hmm.
And it demands your attention and engagement. And of course, Hollywood has no real, they don't care if it engages you or not as long as you pay.
Right. Ticket sales.
And lots of people pay.
Yeah.
So, I'm arguing that we risk, as a society, we risk...
But, I mean, I don't think people who are generally listening to podcasts and reading blogs about the media they consume are interested also in discussing it, clearly. Otherwise, they wouldn't go and read blogs or reviews or listen to podcasts.
Well, they might. They might be interested in discussing it.
Right.
Where it is the veneer of... whatever the show is that they're watching. I mean, I'm shocked at the amount that people can talk about Mecca without actually talking about Mecca, you know, talking about how cool something is.
Without the implications.
And you don't even necessarily, in order for it to work, in order for the magic of narrative to work, mm-hmm. you don't even necessarily need to be aware of it.
Right.
But...
Although I do think in the last forum thread, when I reviewed Gundam Unicorn... Part one. Did I review part two this? No, I just turned in part.
Interviewed part two.
I just turned in part two. But after part one, people really did get into the forums about, like, eventually, like, discussing, is Zeon justified in their actions?
Yeah.
And what did versus the Federation?
Mm-hmm.
And they started to go back and forth. And I didn't read all of it because I haven't seen a bunch of Gundam. And I'm like, I don't know all the stuff that Zeon has done and whatever. But they really did discuss it on a deep level instead of just being like, robots are cool or whatever.
Well, I approve of that.
Well, you should go back and read that thread.
But, well, I started to. I read
it's on page
it after
five
it
or six of the comments.
Posted. Yeah.
That was trickling in like days later.
Okay,
like,
well,
later
that's,
in the week.
That's fine, but it's not merely you know, discovering that things are really in shades of gray.
Yeah.
Which is the same as saying, well, let's agree to disagree. A way of shutting down debate rather than actually dealing with the guts of the issue. Point is not necessarily to answer,
yeah.
but to realize that you must answer. Does that make sense?
I suppose so.
That if you put yourself in these situations, there are going to be consequences
mm-hmm.
based on how you act.
Yeah.
And even if you don't act.
Okay.
And so it's necessary. It is good. It is a social good when you consider these things.
It's good for society.
Yeah, I think so.
Just when an individual thinks about it.
And I think that the creator of Gantz thinks so.
Yeah.
I think that that's what Gantz is an exercise in putting yourself in other people's shoes in extreme situations. And that's what good narrative should do.
But my ultimate conclusion with Gantz is sort of like, there are important things in it, and there's some meaty moral stuff, but the veneer of, like, the thick layer that you have to get through of unstomachable things is so unstomachable that the audience shrinks, that you can't make it, like, in one way, like, Gantz is a best-selling manga, and it appeals to, or was, except for the piracy or whatever, it appeals to a lot of people who want to read it because of the shock factor and, you know, the word of mouth. But on the other hand, it, like, shuts out part of the audience because it's so extreme that, like, a large part of the people will never get to the core of the message because
that's
too ridiculous.
That's true of pretty much anything.
Anything? If it's too scary, a certain amount of the public just won't watch it.
Right, but a certain amount of the public will watch it that wouldn't watch it otherwise.
That's true. I guess I hate to... be arguing on the side of, like, that will limit our audience. Because, I mean, if I'm making a show or something and there's a question that comes up, like, a certain segment of the audience will be totally offended if we do this one thing. And we will lose that demographic by including this one thing in the show. And I think, in general, you should include it. Like, whatever it is, it's probably meaty enough that it's worthwhile.
It depends on what it is, because tell you, that's how most, you know, modern anime is made. But the things that are it.
Right. It's like a broad category.
That's what's actually morally reprehensible, right?
Right. But I mean, like, in American TV, I feel like everything has to be utterly whitewashed and follow, like, a very specific set of rules, because you put in certain kinds of jokes, you'll lose the, you know, Peoria or whatever. And if you put in this one kind of thing, then nobody in the South will watch it. And if you do this one thing, you'll offend the PTA, and then no parents will let kids watch the show. And if you do something else, then you'll offend a bunch of Jewish people, and so, or whatever. Like, there's something, there's always something. And so in the end, you end up with very middle ground entertainment that doesn't try to push edges very much.
Well, which tends to be offensive to the minority demographic who aren't well represented within it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, this is this guy who's the philosopher who is, I don't know if it's fair to call him a fascist philosopher, but certainly an authoritarian of sorts. Carl Schmitt, who is going through a renaissance now. I guess the Chinese are all over him.
I don't know who he is.
Well, you've heard me discuss with Mike on occasion.
Really bad with names.
Okay, so
I don't even know which Mike you're talking about.
Zoe's Mike.
Okay.
Anyway, his argument is that, or, you know, one of his arguments is that no matter what you do, you are going to end up offending someone.
Okay.
So, and I think the example that he gives is, you know, you put a tax on wheat or something, you're going to end up hitting the Jews harder than you would otherwise because they eat matzah.
Okay.
And he says, you should just embrace it.
Just go with it.
Just pick your enemies, man. Pick your enemies. He wasn't really in favor of an open society, though. Anyway.
A bigger topic.
What was the point here?
I don't know. We should probably wrap this up.
Well, I suppose. Is there anything else that hasn't been addressed?
What, in Gantz?
Well, just in general.
By the... Oh, the pacing of the... like, if you read Shelf Life, I cover it there. The pacing of the show is very bad. Gantz should be about 18 episodes
long. Oh, yeah. Gantz is not a good show. Like...
I don't know if we've gotten that across.
There is a laundry list of problems there. But it's...
Someone ought to recut it in such a way that it's not painstakingly slow to watch.
And I wouldn't want them to remake it, but if only they'd made it differently the first time.
Right.
And there was...
Apparently the live action film is also horrible.
Yeah.
Like, that's just what I've heard. They don't make...
Surprised.
They make Kay so he's not a jerk, and then...
Yeah, what's the point?
What's the point of the whole show?
But it's interesting. And some of it is entertaining, although...
It's hard to watch.
It gets a little thin, yeah.
It's hard to watch for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
That's it, I guess. We haven't mentioned the earthquake in Japan or anything. That happened.
That's almost another show unto itself, though.
It's true. I just want to acknowledge that is recorded after the Tohoku earthquake.
I acknowledged it when I said that it was too soon to make the joke about the Talento...
Yeah. In the room that shakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you've been looking at all those Tutsun 4chan jokes.
Tutsun.
They show like an Itai car that's been destroyed in the earthquake, and then have the caption, Tutsun, T-S-U-N.
Yeah.
Tutsun.
Lols.
All right. I guess we'll go to bed. Oh. I want to mention about the worst day of Dave's life. Because we went to a really great bar with him, and... Well, from our perspective...
I wouldn't say it was really great, firstly.
Okay, but we went to like a bar that had fancy beer, because Dave only drinks beer. And Graziella was out of town. I'm now talking about seeing things from the other person's point of view. This is my point of view if you listen to Fast Karate and a recent episode in March. So we knew Graziella was out of town. Dave wasn't getting out of work at the time that he said he was or whatever. Like, if he was supposed to get out of work at 8, he got out at 9. And so We had to wait for several hours, like a while, in this bar where we said we would meet him. And I'd read about it online, and I'd never been there before, so I didn't really know what to expect. And it was difficult to get seats at the bar, and it was really tiny inside. So we had a couple of beers before he showed up. And then when he showed up, we thought he was only going to stay for a couple of beers and then go back. Apparently, he thought he was going to go back to, I guess, near where he works and buy a shawarma. And then go, and that was going to be his dinner. So maybe he hadn't eaten dinner yet, and that was a serious problem because the beer was extra strong because it was like, you know, fancy beer. And we stayed for like four drinks, like more than we should have. And he kept leaving to like smoke cigarettes and call Graziella because you can't smoke in bars anymore. And then coming back. And if anything, Dave only looked drunk at the end. Like he didn't look like out of his mind. It didn't look like, are you going to make it home okay? Like, you know, I've seen other people get severely drunk and you can tell usually, and you put them in a cab and make sure the cab driver knows their address and whatever, like, or invite them to your place or something like that. Dave was not blind drunk. He was not like stumbling around. He wasn't like throwing up on the street or anything, any of those other signs of drunkenness. He seemed all right. What he revealed later on the podcast was that he was unacceptably horribly drunk. He did not want to catch the subway alone with so much time. And he didn't even make it back to get the shawarma. He just went back to his office because it was like 3 a.m. or something and slept on the chairs until he had to work.
He gathered up
a bunch of jackets and slept under some coats and then was horribly hungover and only ate saltines and watched Futurama the next day. And that was, quote unquote, the worst day of his life. I can only say Dave must have had a pretty easy life, but also it wasn't clear that's what was happening. And I don't even think I got hungover from that. And I drank more than he did that night. He's a big guy. What is up with that?
I don't know.
It's because he skipped dinner. I think that's why.
Maybe so.
And he was lonely because Graziella wasn't there.
Not our fault.
Really? And he didn't tell us, like, later he didn't say, do you know what happened, guys? That was horrible. No, he just waited for months and complained about it on his podcast. When was that
which
even?
Is
it was like
usually,
last year.
Which is usually how we find things out from Dave.
Yeah.
Because we hear about them like 4 or 5 months later on his podcast.
Like when we ate at Taco Chulo, we couldn't tell if he liked it or not. He looked like he was having a bad time. And then later on his podcast, he was like, and then they had all these kinds of sour cream and I ordered crazy and it was super great and it was awesome. And I'm like, you didn't say that. We watched you eat it in apparent misery. He's kind of hard to read. Can't tell if he's having fun or not.
What can you do?
I don't know. Missing Gans. Okigenio.